Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is James K. Galbraith, who is a professor at the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Policy at the University of Texas at Austin. He's also a senior scholar at the Levy Economics Institute and serves as chair of the Board of Economists for Peace and Security. His books include Balancing Acts, Technology, Finance, and the American Future, Created Unequal, The Crisis in American Pay, and The Predator State, How Conservatives Abandon the Free Market and Why Liberals Should Too. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Galbraith.
Good to be with you.
And the current situation between the White House and the Congress over the economy with the sequester looming, and of course that's been delayed with the fiscal cliff deal, but it's coming up soon. Some people have suggested that the Congress should take the Hippocratic Oath on the economy. What's your suggestion?
Well, it would certainly be an improvement over their current practice, which is to do no good.
So what is their motive, though? Is it that so many of the Republicans in the House are free market ideologues, that they honestly believe that the sky is falling from the deficit, and that we have to, that is the priority, as opposed to reviving the economy in order to generate revenues?
Well, I think the concept of honest belief is a bit alien to the current American political discourse on these issues. What we are seeing is a targeted attack on particular public programs and public services, and behind targeted attacks, even if they come in under a cloud of propaganda, there is usually some economic interest. So, for example, I read in the paper today that the post office is planning to suspend and eliminate Saturday mail delivery. Does that mean that there will no longer be services available to do this? No, the private sector will, for a very substantially higher price, be willing to deliver packages for you on Saturdays. So this is something which has a serves a very strong particular business interest. Similarly, when we hear proposals that were being spoken of just a few months ago to raise the eligibility age for Medicare, what you're looking at is a proposal to force the partial privatization of health care for that part of the population, which is in the age range of 65, 66, who would be obliged to continue to pay the premiums to private insurers. And so you can imagine there's a private economic interest behind that. And one can go down the list of these proposals. There's almost always somebody who is going to benefit from the curtailment of the public services and the public insurance, social insurance programs that we have built up over the years.
But James Galbraith, just recently there was a report on the fourth quarter of last year and how much growth dipped to an alarming degree, and much of that was attributed to a reduction in defense spending. So if that's a harbinger of what will happen if the sequester goes through and these enormous amount of money is taken out of the economy, we're talking about pretty much economics 101 here, and whether it's ideology or whether it's a desire on the part of the Republicans to frustrate and diminish Obama's ability to govern and essentially make his presidency fail, the consequences for America are pretty profound. So,
well, when we do have this mechanical effect that when the government cuts its purchases of goods and services, in the fourth quarter it was defense purchases, then that is a straightforward dollar-for-dollar reduction of GDP. So a generalized program to curtail government services, to, again, the Postal Service example, will reduce output directly. That doesn't mean that it isn't good business for some private enterprise. On the contrary. And so I think one can clearly infer the motives. I mean, you do have people. I saw that Speaker Boehner yesterday, the day before, said something to the effect that he was astonished that the president or somebody seemed to think that spending, government spending, adds to growth. Well, if he knew anything, and I'm sure he does know that, in fact, as a matter of accounting, if the government buys an aircraft carrier, that is added to total output and is an increase in the in economic activity and counts as economic growth. So one has to assume that that Mr. Boehner is not completely ignorant of this, and that he's making a comment like this to obscure the issue for some other purpose. The other possibility is that he doesn't, in fact, know how the national economy works and how the accounting mechanisms actually work. But I find that to be a very remote possibility, frankly.
Again, I'm speaking with James K. Galbraith, who is a professor at the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Policy at the University of Texas at Austin, and he's the author of The Predator State, How Conservatives Abandoned the Free Market and Why Liberals Should Too. But if these cuts go through and the economy this quarter will predictably, the growth will go down considerably. The Congressional Budget Office have already suggested that growth will go down to 1.1%. So you're getting close to two quarters in a row, which would indicate a return of a recession. So those stark facts have surely got to get their attention. Whether or not their financial backers who were looking at the post office to grab up post office real estate at a fire sale price, that notwithstanding, there are bigger issues here, surely.
Well, you would think so, but it's not obvious that those larger issues are of any concern to particular members of Congress. They have a concern about who is funding them, who is going to be supporting them in their next campaign, or about the threat they might face from an even more right-wing opponent in a primary. And that's a direct, immediate concern to a member of Congress. The possibility that somebody, most likely, you know, most people in some other district, will become unemployed as a result, or that the nation might enter a recession, is a much more remote issue as far as this particular kind of political atmosphere is concerned. Clearly.
So if they go ahead with these automatic cuts, and as the CBO recently predicted, it will reduce growth by 1.5% of GDP, do you think that we'll officially be in another recession, or the last one has come back? I don't quite know.
The reality is that the crisis that began in 2007 and came to a climax in 2008 has never really ended. We have a far smaller share of the population actually employed now than was true 4 or 5 years ago. And yes, we hit bottom, and the basic mechanisms that we have available to stabilize the economy did work and have worked, and we've experienced a little bit of economic expansion since the bottom was hit, but a full recovery hasn't happened. So I'm reluctant to say that, you know, talk in terms of a new crisis. The reality is we're in a fundamentally different world. Am I really concerned about the possibility that we're going to have another very sharp downturn, repeat the experience of 2009? I think that's a bit remote, precisely because we still do have the stabilizing mechanisms, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, the Federal Reserve is still there. These institutions are still there. They're still available to do their jobs. The Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation is still assuring people that the money they have in the bank is safe. And I think these institutions, for the moment, are still functioning. Will the steps that you're describing make matters more difficult? Yes, they will. They'll make matters substantially more difficult for quite a few people. No question about it.
Well, the president, of course, has tried to head off the sequester by suggesting an interim step of making some cuts and some increases in revenue and postponing the day of reckoning here, if you will. Now, he got pretty soundly and somewhat derisively shot down by Speaker Boehner. And I find myself in an odd situation defending defense spending here, but the Pentagon officials have said that up to 800,000 of the military civilian employees would have to work one day less a week because of the cuts, and the Air Force would have to curtail orders of Lockheed Martin's F-35 fighter jet, which is probably an extremely good idea, frankly, because it's a complete turkey. But they'd also delay a new version of the Reaper drone, which obviously is very much in demand in terms of the Pentagon's current needs as opposed to the F-35, which is a Cold War, incredibly expensive and obsolete toy. So I guess what I'm saying here is that you can really see what a blunt instrument this sequester is.
Well, I think that's true. I in the case of the defense budget, what is happening is that we're looking at a number that's going to come down anyway. It was blown up to an extraordinarily high level in the excitement of the Bush years, the aftermath of 9/11, the war in Afghanistan, the war in Iraq. And those numbers are coming down. It would have been an extremely good thing if we had used this pressure of the sequester to have a rational reevaluation of what we're spending the defense money on. And you mentioned the F-35 is a very important example of that. Of course, the reality is that as we did that, whether it was something driven by the sequester or something driven by a rational reexamination of what our national security needs are, it's going to be taking spending out of the economy. I can't deny that. And then the question is, how do we maintain the overall level of spending? What national needs should we be pursuing that we have not yet funded properly, both in the public sector and in the private sector? And that's a conversation we should be having. But the notion here that we're actually have the two poles of the debate are, as you have said, this completely misleading and meretricious argument that comes from Speaker Boehner and his acolytes that says that we should be that we somehow, as we cut spending, we're going to get an increase in economic growth directly as a result of it. And then on the president's side, the kind of defensive reaction which says we shouldn't cut spending precipitously, so we'll cut it a little bit and hope to defer the big cuts until some later time when somehow miraculously the economy will have recovered, which is also it's a defensive argument. You can make more excuses for it, but it is not going to, it's an argument which is still very far away from a direct and effective attack on the actual problems that we face. Such an approach would require us to rethink and recast the way we talk about these problems and not to be in the position of saying, oh, well, the government spending, whatever it's for, is always a drag on the economy, something which is not true.
Well, I don't know whether data and facts play a part in this, the politics of the moment. You know, one would hope that there is some kind of economic patriotism and some...
you're an optimist.
Well, at least a recognition of reality and
you're even more of an optimist.
Well, a belief in data. Then I'm truly ridiculous.
He's doubling down on his optimism.
Well, but I mean, the Congressional Budget Office just projected that the federal budget deficit will drop to 5.3% of the nation's total output by the end of the year. So I guess that nobody noticed that on the conservative side or the Tea Party side. And that's roughly half of what the deficit was relative to the size of the economy in 2009. So are the deficit hawks operating on fumes here? What's going on?
Oh, I do think that the lobbying groups that have been set up, the front organizations that the Peterson Foundation, the Peter G. Peterson Foundation, established in Washington to continually drone on about this issue, have run out of credibility. They have been playing the little boy who cried wolf for years now, saying that 2 years ago they were saying that there would be a major crisis in the financial markets if we didn't gut Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid by now. Well, we haven't done it, and there is absolutely no sign of a crisis in the financing of the U.S. government. So their credibility on this question is really quite shot. What you have instead is a kind of much more raw and, in many ways, really a direct attack on government functions as such. And that's what's emerging from the Republican side right now. It's clear that as the deficit issue, the so-called debt problem loses credibility, what they are saying is directly what they mean, which is that they want to cut back on government services. They want to cut back on the public sector. They want to privatize things in order that their clients in the private sector can profit from it. It's what is becoming clear is a very transparent view of the motives behind this.
So, James Galbraith, if Pete Peterson, who's a Wall Street billionaire, if his real motives are to get rid of Social Security so the stock market can get its hands on all of that money, obviously that's what George W. Bush proposed when he was reelected and when he said, I've got some political capital now, I'm going to spend it. And he went ahead with this plan to privatize Social Security. And had we privatized Social Security with the subsequent crash in 2008, every American would be incredibly impoverished. So I don't understand how, one, Peterson can make that argument in the light of what just happened, and two, why the Obama administration bought into the Simpson-Bowles deficit reduction package, which was in part financed by Pete Peterson, who paid the salaries of the staff of the Simpson-Bowles Commission.
Well, let's separate things out here. I do think that, as I said, Pete Peterson's arguments have lost credibility, and his operations, which include a number of front organizations in Washington, have basically been reduced to caricatures of themselves. You're quite right that had we privatized or cut back Social Security when President Bush proposed it, then we would not have had the stabilizing effect that Social Security did have on the economy in 2009. It was a major force in preventing everything from going completely to hell. And so that's something which is extremely important. Eric Larson has a book called The People's Pension, The History of the Social Security Wars, in which he documents this really quite impressively. On the question of the motivations of the White House in setting up a commission, I think we have to be agnostic. I'm sure there were people in the White House who were hoping that the commission would come up with a program that would cover the administration in deficit-cutting glory. There may have been other people in the White House who felt that the purpose of a commission is to kick an issue down the road until it dies and nothing happens. And if there were such people, they were, it's hard to fault them. The Simpson-Bowles Commission blathered on for a while, produced a report which its own commissioners would not vote for, in which, for example, it's Paul Ryan did not vote for it. Then they have been talking about it ever since as though it were some great heroic document, which it is not. But the reality is that nothing came of it, which is good.
Well, just in closing, James Galbraith, you mentioned in an article that you supported Jack Lew for Treasury. Do you think he'll be an improvement over Geithner? Because one of the main criticisms now that's coming out about Geithner as a result of the PBS documentary on that questioned why nobody on Wall Street's gone to jail for the crash of the economy, and a lot of fingers are pointed to Geithner and, of course, Lenny Brewer at the Justice Department. But will Lew be an improvement, at least not necessarily putting bankers in jail, but what is
The failure of the prosecution of massive bank fraud lies with the Justice Department, not with the Treasury Department. But it's fair to say that under Secretary Geithner, the Treasury Department was the leading voice for the view that you couldn't do anything to the banking sector that they might disapprove of, because that would cause all kinds of unimaginable harm. And this was extremely frustrating to serious regulators, including Sheila Bair, a Republican appointee, who documents the obstruction and difficulties she faced from the Treasury Department through her term into President Obama's administration in a very good book called Bull by the Horns. So we have the record of that very clear. Jack Lew, I really can't speak to how he will perform. He's someone whom I knew and liked and respected a lot when we were both very young members of the staff of the U.S. Congress in the early 1980s. He is a lifelong public servant with a record of accomplishment, really, and capable administration at the Office of Management and Budget. And so far as I know, as the chief of staff in the White House, and I expect that he will bring an independent point of view to the Treasury Department. So I think it's a good appointment. It's an appointment certainly that the Senate should confirm easily. I'm sure it will, I'm looking forward to seeing how Jack does as Secretary of the Treasury. And I think we can judge that performance after we've seen it.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, James Galbraith.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with James Galbraith, who is a professor in the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Policy at the University of Texas at Austin. He's also a senior scholar at the Levy Economics Institute and serves as chair of the Board of Economists for Peace and Security. His books include Balancing Acts, Technology, Finance, and the American Future, Created Unequal, The Crisis in American Pay, and The Predator State, How Conservatives Abandon the Free Market and Why Liberals Should Too. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again on Sunday at 11 a.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. The headline written down.